failing.
On radio. On radio. More of the good stuff. CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. It's Tuesday, 1 p.m. as usual. I'm your host, Delisha Olumbus. I'm joined in studio this week by Simon Allison of the Daily Maverick, Paul Mason from Amandla.mobi, and Andrea Teagle, also working with us at the Daily Maverick. We're going to start up things a little bit differently this week. We're going to try and engage with some of the lighthearted stuff before we get into the death and destruction that seems to be dominating our news cycles as usual. We're going to have a fun fact of the day. I've asked all our guests to bring in a fact. I see Paul shaking his head. And let's go to Andrea quickly. It's something you've been working on, and the first thing as part of the first thing program, we put out a fact every day. You've got a fact for us. What's your fact for this week?
So my fact is that you don't actually need eyes in order to see. I thought that was very interesting. The field of study is called electro-tactile stimulation. And basically how it works is a blind person can put on a pair of glasses, and on the glasses is mounted a little miniature video camera, and it transmits the images from the camera to a small device in the person's mouth. And there it's translated into electrical pulses on your tongue. So now at first, obviously, nothing's really going to happen, but after a while, your brain picks up that that's very similar to visual input, and it starts interpreting these pulses as an image, which basically then allows the person to see through their tongue in a manner of speaking. So I thought that was very cool.
Holy crap.
That is actually very, very cool.
And has this been trialed? Has this been piloted around the world? I mean, have there been cases, medical trials out there?
I think the technology is reasonably old already. I think it's been around for a few years already. It's very expensive and not really feasible. And the image that you get, obviously there's no color involved. Like the electrical impulses can only stimulate light and dark by the strength of the pulse. So, I think it's better than not having vision. It's not very good. And there's also, other technology like bionic eyes, which probably works a bit better, but I didn't think was as interesting for the fact.
Wow, that's a pretty good fact. I'm not sure we can trump that.
I don't know if I'd call it a fun fact, but it was a cool fact.
Well, it's a cool fact. I mean, Simon, have you got one for us?
I'm not sure I can compare with the miracle of giving sight to
people without eyes.
But my fun fact is around typography. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't sound promising, I know, and probably is only promising for people like me that really like fonts and, looking at the written word. And this is about, people who write to you. And I get it a lot with journalists send work to me and that I am editing. And they put two spaces after the full stop.
Oh, that grates me.
Where does this come from?
Where does it come from?
It's so frustrating. And so the fact is that two spaces, people, is wrong. Okay? It's wrong. You're doing it wrong. And now let me explain the background to this, because it's quite interesting.
We only want one stop here.
The two spaces thing came from the age of the typewriter. So now, when you had a typewriter, each letter, no matter if it was an I, which is thin, or an F, which is a bit thicker, they all had to occupy exactly the same space, because that's how a typewriter works, So each letter occupies the same space on the page. So even within the words, there's quite a bit of random looking spacing. So that means when you're typing a whole document, you need two spaces after the full stop when you're using a typewriter, mm-hmm. so you can actually see where the sentence begins, and you can see it's not just a random space within a word. However, we don't use typewriters anymore, people. And typographers are unanimous that this is an anachronism. And
it's an abomination.
It is an abomination. The convention now is one space. It's not a convention. It is a rule. If any of you tweet us using two spaces after your full stops, we will ignore you.
Yeah. That's a surefire. Just out of curiosity, who here has actually written anything on a typewriter? As in used it to write something, other than sort of, just push down on a button that you saw in a museum or someone's house once.
I went to a wedding and they had a typewriter as like their guest book, and you'd write them something. Cool. And that was pretty cool. But it was difficult,
My mom hung on to hers, I think, till I was about 10. So I have seen a functional typewriter.
Yeah, I haven't. No, I can't say that I have. I think that, you know, sort of in a museum or somewhere, there was a, you know, just bang around, push one or two things down. But it wasn't even functional. It was, you know, it was out of date.
I did find it was a very viscerally satisfying experience, you know, because there is that, you know, there's the noise sound and the sound. Click. There's more effort that goes into each letter. Yeah. It's and there's also the sense of permanence. You can't make mistakes with a typewriter.
Typix. That was the rise and fall of Typix. Paul, you don't per se have a fact for us, but you've got some, you know, in your dealings on Amandla.mobi and some of the things that you guys are doing. Maybe just tell us a little bit about Amandla.mobi and what it does, and then take us into this, you know, those interesting tidbits that you wanted to suggest earlier.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks so much for the opportunity to come and talk to you guys about Amandla.mobi. We've just launched about a month ago. And, you know, we're an organization that's basically working to turn every cell phone in South Africa into a democracy-building tool. And the idea is that, I mean, I'm sure for many South Africans, you might be reading something in the Daily Maverick or watching the evening news, and you see an injustice. It could be police stealing, confiscating blankets from the homeless. It could be what's happened in Marikana. And you might feel outraged. But the question is, how do we turn that outrage into something, you know, tangible? How do we actually
actionable,
go about, you know, achieving social justice? So I think for us, you know, we're a social justice organization that runs campaigns on cell phones. So no matter what type of cell phone you have, whether it's a normal basic phone or a feature phone or a smartphone, you can join our campaigns. And our campaigns are also in multiple languages. So the idea is that we want to basically be able to reach as many people as possible to rebuild the promise of a just, people-powered South Africa. 20 years of democracy, the question is, how do we actually deepen our democracy going forward? And in particular, for those who are most affected by injustices, those who are most affected by poverty, violence, and corruption, how do we actually enable those people to be able to, you know, join campaigns, coordinate and build community power to be able to achieve justice and hold people to account? So that's, you know, the idea behind Amandla.mobi. It's just, you know, there's just three of us at the moment. It was founded by myself, an amazing community organizer by the name of Kuketsa Murti, and a campaigner by the name of Sibela Munukwa. So the three of us kind of came together and set up Amandla.mobi, and launched about a month or so ago.
Okay. And what happens once you've sort of mobilized the community and the people and saying, well, this is something that we want to take action on? What happens then? What's the next step?
Well, the next step is really, it's about we're aggregating people's voices and, you know, delivering them to a decision maker. So in the instance of the allegations around Joburg Metro cops confiscating blankets from the homeless, we basically launched a campaign. People could join in. And once people joined that campaign, we delivered those names to the Metro Police and said, look, these people feel as citizens that you're not doing enough to protect all members of our community, especially the most vulnerable, like the homeless. And so it's really about, you know, keeping that pressure on, you know, decision makers to hold them to account. And we're actually really excited. We this morning when we were talking to the Metro Police, they've actually, you know, they've received our campaign. They see what our campaign was basically asking, that the police send their officers to go volunteer at soup kitchens to hand out blankets, not just confiscate them. And the police have actually agreed to look into that and actually send their cops.
What sort of numbers did you get on that campaign?
That campaign in particular wasn't actually a lot of numbers. Mm-hmm. It's about 150 compared to the campaign we've been running to get miners shot down on ETV and SABC, which was over 3,000. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, you know, you don't actually necessarily need huge numbers to be able to actually reach the other decision makers.
So, in the example of the Metro cops, they did receive it, they did take it seriously, they did follow the normal channels that you would with a normal petition or normal galvanization of people's voices.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, definitely. They definitely were receptive. I think basically because we weren't necessarily very aggressive. Mm-hmm. And we were also saying, look, we want to work with you. You know, as citizens, we want to engage constructively with our police force and actually say, you know, we want to ensure that you're actually, you know, doing your duty to actually support vulnerable members of our community.
And so do you print out a list of the names and give the names? These are the people who supported and put their names to this petition?
Yeah, we do. So we normally, last Friday when we delivered over 3,000 signatures to the SABC and ETV, you know, we printed out on hard copy so they could see. Mm-hmm. So when the ETV spokesperson said that they felt they had adequately covered what had happened at Marikana, you know, we had 20 widows of the Marikana massacre and over 3,000 names, this huge, you know, wad of paper to actually say, well, we actually disagree with you. We feel that, you know, the stories of miners need to be told. So, yeah, we do you know, endeavor to actually print out those petitions so people can actually see, you know, these are the individuals who have actually taken the time out of their day to actually, you know, read about this issue, join a campaign, add their voice. And a lot of people, when they join a campaign, often, you know, add comments. We had a lot of people, particularly on the Marikana campaign, talking about the fact that they are TV license payers. You know, they pay for their TV license, and they want, as citizens and TV license payers, for, you know, our free-to-air broadcaster and, you know, public broadcaster to be able to, you know, explore
have some,
what happened.
Some, and have some sort of input into the programming that goes on goes on to what they're paying for.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we jump into the Marikana stuff, because we're going to dedicate the second half of the show just talking about Marikana, the anniversary, and this petition to get Minor Shot Down broadcast on the free-to-air stations. You said there were some facts or some sort of fun facts you could contribute from some of the stuff you've done at Amandla.mobi.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, before I left our offices in Bromfontein to come over here and do this interview, I was talking to, you know, Kuketsu and Sabelo, and we, you know, had been asking questions around, you know, the importance of a documentary like Minor Shot Down being shown on ETV and SABC. And we thought, you know, there's a lot of shows being shown on ETV. Surely they could maybe, you know, stop showing one of them. So we took a straw poll.
A lot of repeats.
Yeah, a lot of repeats. You know, so Sabelo, personally, who's our, one of our lead campaigners, felt very strongly that, you know, WWE, for instance, that's not going to go down very well. You know, a lot of wrestling fans in South Africa. You know, there's a couple other shows. So, like, for instance, we would like to
furthering
encourage
the cause of democracy by, yes, by the ultimate warrior.
Absolutely, ultimate warrior.
God rest his soul, by the way.
Yes, yes. We felt that, you know, Ripley's Believe It or Not, for instance, maybe, you know, an interesting show, but in the case of, you know, finding out what actually happened and Marikana, 44 people massacred, might be more important for ETV to kind of show Minor Shot Down than that. Or, for instance, later in September at 11 p.m. at night, there's a show called Bikini Babes.
I watched that.
Yeah, sorry, Simon. So the campaign is at Mala.mobi and probably 3,000 odd. A thousand other people kind of feel that maybe Minor Shot Down might be slightly more important. But also Ice Age, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, that was the other one we thought, you know, ETV maybe, you know.
It really is an incredible failure of our public broadcasting. And it shows, you know, particularly the SABC, which has such reach and such such influence in communities that more elite media, of which the Daily Maverick, unfortunately, is a leading voice, communities we just don't reach. And you know, all these little academic debates about should Cloudy and his non-matric qualifications be allowed to lead the organization, this is where you find they really have an impact in something like Minor Shot Down, which really should be required watching for every citizen of this country. That's what our people should be watching.
Well, very briefly, and we'll come back to it later, I mean, that's probably the reason, is because it is so influential that maybe that's the reason they don't want to show it. Okay, I've got a fact. I've been hanging on to this one. Actually, I got it from a really cool podcast. It's one of my favorite podcasts. It's the QI team, the researchers from QI. They have a podcast every week called There's No Such Thing as a Fish. Anyway, that's the name of the podcast. But the fact is, and the way they presented it was that hippopotami, is that the plural hip? General consensus, hippopotami.
We'll roll with that.
Yeah, well, hippopotami. Male hippopotami have evolved so that their penises can retract during times of battle with other male hippopotami to protect themselves. So they have retractable peni. And in addition to that, they don't have a scrotum. So the male hippopotamus organs are my fact of the day. Although the little bit of work that I did to have a look at and to try and substantiate that, not that I won't rely on the work of these highly paid researchers, is that it actually only comes out for mating purposes, and the rest of the time it's retracted and in its, you know, cozy little pouch.
You know, I wonder if the history of humanity would be different if men could put away their penises when they were not mating. If this wasn't such a such an influential, you know.
But you have a point there, Simon. I think if it wasn't it wasn't thing. So the other thing I've asked our guests to do as well is get a tweet of the week, something that's interested them, something that's piqued their interest or moved them or got them really upset. So who wants to go first on this one?
I cannot find the actual tweet. I don't remember reading it, so I unfortunately can't give it in its exact wording and can't give credit where credit is due. But it was a wonderful point. And it's about all these the sort of race riots in Ferguson in the States right now, which are quite fascinating, an indication that, you know, all is not right in the shining democracy on the Hill. Mm. What the tweet said was, look at Miley. It said, Miley Cyrus and Justin Bieber, that's who it was addressed to, you love to appropriate black culture when it suits you, but when black culture needs you to appropriate it, you're not there. And you're basically just saying, look, you know, you can't be black for the good times. Mm-hmm. You can't just, you know, have the, you know, the style swagger, and the swagger and the, and you know, you buy into these, you know, I mean, almost stereotypical notions that you see people like Miley Cyrus and Justin Bieber portraying in their music videos and their notion and their shows. And yet here you have a real race issue. You know, Ferguson, what's happening there is the reality of what it's like to be black in America today. And that's not a reality that Justin Bieber or Miley Cyrus are prepared to share. And I think there's a broader point for all of us that, you know, it's fun to, you know, act the part and to take on some of these cultural things. But that's not being multicultural. That's not being culturally sensitive. That's just playing.
Well, it's just taking advantage, right?
Yeah, it is.
For the sake of the persona and the marketing side of things. Mm. Paul, have you got a tweet that's kind of stuck out this last week?
Yeah, I mean, you know, about this time last week, we, you know, we're on Twitter and we saw this amazing tweet by Tio Molefe talking about the blackface incident at the University of Pretoria. And, you know, he just single-handedly completely demolished any argument that there was, you know, those students were just having a bit of fun.
And he did a series, didn't he? He explained it in a series of tweets and kind of, you know, attempted to break it down bit by bit. I think it was like 10 tweets or something.
Yeah. We should say Tio Molefe is a former Daily Maverick writer.
We got some credit in the molding molding of the mind.
And that's what we actually launched a campaign on that issue. Actually, you know, how do we turn all this Twitter outrage about this blackface incident into, you know, a united voice saying to actually, you know, the vice chancellor at the University of Pretoria, you need to do something serious about the culture of racism on campus. The fact that some, you know, white South Africans still think that, you know, the blackface incident isn't actually a problem. I think is really, really problematic. So that's, you know, it was a tweet that inspired us to launch a campaign. So, I think, important.
Yeah, we could probably spend a long time talking about that old blackface incident. And especially that, you know, that perception or that way of thinking by most, you know, most white people, what's wrong with this? You know, and we can spend days on that.
Paul, has there been a reaction from the University of Pretoria?
We haven't received a formal reaction yet. The campaign, I think, is still, you know, we're building momentum, talking to a lot of people in the Twitterverse about, you know, we can talk and debate about this, but it's actually time to, you know, put your name down on a piece of paper and actually say, look, I actually stand for, you know, a part of a social movement demanding that there's a change in this racist culture, that we need to actually do something serious. It's not adequate to say, you know, I grew up as a white South African watching Leon Schuster. And therefore, you know.
Yeah, that's fine and dandy. And that gives you
how does he get away with it?
It was very interesting after we ran this campaign that it was either ETV or SABC announced a Leon Schuster marathon, which I think was very unfortunate, but it's okay. You know, we,
And it is sad that those movies, even now in this modern day, you know, come out and are still the bestsellers. They top the, you know, top the movie ratings.
Well, I think it's also very interesting to think, you know, 10 years ago we didn't have Twitter. You know, if you think about Leon Schuster at the height of his career, you know, these discussions about, you know, blackface weren't really happening. And I think this is the power of technology. It actually allows us to amplify the voices of people who are actually affected by these issues. And it kind of levels the playing field in our democracy for everyday citizens to actually engage with these issues. So I think, you know, Twitter and Facebook and social media has their role to play. But I think something for us we're struggling with is, you know, not everyone's on Twitter, not everyone's on Facebook. So how do we actually mobilize people through cell phones? And that's why a lot of our campaigns are run through USSD, like a short code. So people can join campaigns by dialing *120 *4729# hash, or also on Mixit. And we're actually mobilizing a lot of people through Mixit. So I think, you know, we can have these conversations when it's more inclusive of everyone.
I'm going to go out and just relay my tweet of the week, which is by a Daily Maverick journalist, Rebecca Davis. This came out on Sunday, and Rebecca's great to follow on any given day. And on Sunday, she came up and she tweeted, I'm just catching up on the Hrikwistat conviction. So the accused raped his own sister, fucking hell. And this was obviously in response to the fact that the accused had now been named because he's now become you're no longer a minor. And Rebecca, you know, tweeted her, you know, her surprise and just disgusted at, you know, the fact that this was a son and a brother who had done this to the rest of his family, and tweeted with the expletive at the end, you know, fucking hell. Which then prompted a response from someone who we can probably only describe as a complete and utter knob jockey. His response is fucking hell okay in Daily Maverick's copy? Surely you can be one of the boys some other way. And this kind of like, you know, stirred a little bit of a Twitter war, and ended up in Rebecca writing this great piece, which was, you know, in defense of the sweary woman, which is, you know, why is it okay when men swear but not okay when women swear? Why does it make it, is it more profane or more disgusting when a woman uses profanity to express her feelings? And, you know, and systematically breaks down this very sexist approach to, and you know, what seems to be quite a big problem out there, that you know, women can't use the same expletive language as we do, and, you know, and adding some other arguments into the fact that, you know, it's, you know, the people who use profanity the most are the, you know, people right at the, you know, the higher echelons of society, and people right at the bottom, and it's the ones in the middle who take the most offense because they trying to aspire or achieve to be those high class citizens. And, you know, I thought that was great, you know, that one tweet then sort of, you know, sparked a reaction and then sparked a great opinion piece, which was, which was then, you know, retweeted and read thousands, and the support from women out there who all sort of,
and men,
yeah,
men.
And men,
and men.
Yeah. It was great to see every, and then it just kind of, it ignited this burst of fucks and shits on Twitter, because everyone was coming out in support and saying, fuck yeah, you know, I support this. This is, you know, it's complete hypocrisy and sexism at its utmost. But with that, I did, you know, I mean, Rebecca identifies herself as a feminist, and that's a word that I don't like, it has some negative connotations for me, and I'm not sure if it's just because of my perceptions as a guy, you know, like this bra-burning, you know, ball-busting, you know, man-hating person. You know, that's kind of my image of, you know, or my what it's been turned out to be. When in actual fact, all it is someone who's trying to fight for the equal treatment of women in our society.
And, you know, Stilly, that image, you know, it is a prevalent one, you know, the bra-burning feminist. I mean, that image was created by men. To discredit feminism. It's precisely, it's another tool, you know, to say, oh, we don't have to listen to them because they're crazy. Whereas feminism, I mean, I call myself a feminist. I think most people, you know, most people that I hang out with are feminists in the way they treat and speak to women.
Yeah, the team at Zamanla Domabi, we definitely identify as feminist. I think, you know, there was this on Twitter and Facebook for a while, there was this thing going around saying that, you know, feminism has changed its name. It's now called common sense. and I think that's really pertinent.
That, yeah.
You know, when you were talking earlier about, you know, this controversy of a woman swearing on Twitter,
yeah,
you know, Rebecca Davis, I mean, that's, in my mind, is this tactic a lot of men use called gaslighting. Where the moment a woman talks about something quite passionately, it's, oh, you're being over-emotional.
Yeah.
And we do, you know, it is disturbing the number of tactics out there every day that are used to, you know, quell the voices of women. So.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's very easy to be dismissive about things that people get worked up about when you're not the person on the receiving end. You know, so I think men often think that women get overly offended, you know, by mildly, you know, what are supposed to just be amusing sexist jokes. But again, I think it's just, if you're not fighting the battle, you can't really understand. And I think it's similar with race issues as well. You know, certain things just aren't amusing, and they're a symptom of deeper prejudices a lot of the time, which unfortunately people don't even realize that they have.
Okay, before we jump into the second half of the show and dedicate that to Marikana, Andrew, you had a tweet of the week that you wanted to put forward.
Yeah, my tweet also speaks to Twitter's ability to get ordinary citizens involved, I guess, and also speaking up for, you know, around issues that they empathize with and care about. So this one was tweeted from a guy in the West Bank in Palestine to Ferguson. And it just says, dear Ferguson, the tear gas used against you was probably tested on us first by Israel. No worries. Stay strong. Love, Palestine. And it also sparked a series of tweets from people in the West Bank showing solidarity for the protesters in Ferguson and telling them how to deal with tear gas and things like that. It also got a little bit controversial because then people were saying, well, you know, why are we making this comparison? The two situations are very different. But I think it was really more about just people empathizing, you know, with other people who were being oppressed in some way in another part of the world. And I think that's very cool.
Well, one person who did make who did use Ferguson as a comparison was Ranjini Munasamy when she wrote about how the riots that were sparked that were a result of what happened in Ferguson with the shooting of Michael Brown, and we've seen the community and the people up in arms and the massive media coverage and the injustice or the focus on the injustice coming out of the poor and tragic shooting of this one person, and then compared that to what's happened at Marikana, with 34 people that were mowed down, and the lack of the lack of response, and whether it's media wise or whether it's just community wise, where the two disparate circumstances around what's happened there with the killing of one person versus the killing of 34 people, and just pointing out these massive discrepancies between the two reactions and what's happened. Why do you think that is, Paul? Why do you think there has been such a big difference between the two situations?
Yeah, I think at the core of it, it's those family members of who were affected in Ferguson, not necessarily, they were able to access some social media and Twitter, and there were a lot of very strong civil society, and the media was, I think, not perfect, but did cover their perspective. Whereas I think by contrast, if you look at Marikana, we're having these huge public debates. Who's to blame? This is a tragedy. But what we are absolutely missing in this entire discussion as a nation, like grappling with South Africa's first post-apartheid massacre, is the voices of the miners themselves and also the widows and family members. And I think, we were disgusted last week when, you're watching the Farland Commission and you have, SABC News and ENCA doing live broadcasts of Mr. X and Cyril Ramaphosa doing their testimonies. But when it came time for the widows to do their testimonies, there's no such live broadcast, live streaming. And I think that, is part of this, this broader problem of we're not really hearing the voices of the widows. The only time we heard about their voices is when, one of the widows collapsed and an ambulance had to be called. That was the headline. Not necessarily the fact that people taking the time to actually sit down with the widows and actually listen to their stories. And, we at Amandla.mobi spent some time with the widows. And, what they have to say is so incredibly powerful. But also, I think there's a language barrier. When we were at SABC and ETV on Friday, there was a lot of journalists wanting just to speak to the widows who could speak English. And I think that's a real tragedy because there's so much to be said, and we're not really giving, the time and effort to make sure their voices are heard. So I think that's, in my mind, a very big difference in where we're engaging these two different issues.
Simon, that reminds me a little bit of the study that the Rhodes School of Journalism did into the Marikana massacre. I don't know if you saw it, but it was... It looked at and it used Greg Marinovich's article in Daily Maverick as a sort of a watershed moment, and looked at the sources of information in the media before that article made it out there. And I'm trying to bring up the exact sort of split, but there was 10% of the media information was coming from Lonmin spokespeople. Mm. The unions were getting another 20%. SAP spokespeople were getting another 20%. And all these other players and government was getting another 20%. And ultimately, and what you saw was, I think it was something like 3% of the source of direct information that was making it into the media before that Greg's piece was coming from the miners themselves. So that they were being completely marginalized. And I think even then, that coverage, that little bit of coverage that was coming out from the miners was basically dedicated around the Muti and that stuff that they were doing. So it reminds me very much of that case. And it's really sad to realize that even after that article and after, the commission's been running and all that, that we don't seem to be in a much better place.
part of it is simple logistics, and you know, so much logistics comes into journalism. Like we were talking with Greg Nicholson a couple of weeks ago, and saying that Marikana would never have become a news story in this country if it had happened in the Eastern Cape. Mm. There's no journalists there.
Yeah.
You know, not a single news organization would have paid for their journalist to fly to the Eastern Cape to cover the story. The fact that it happened in Marikana, an hour and a half away from Johannesburg, meant that we could cover the story. Otherwise, we would not have. It's as simple as that. Mm. Similarly, getting the voices of people on the ground is hard. You have to be on the ground. You have to have the contacts to find them. You have to know where they are. You have to persuade them to trust you. Doing that is good journalism. And that's what we should all be doing. But the truth is, we are required to produce, you know, usually a story a day, sometimes more. There just isn't the time or the resources to do that for many of the journalists in the country. And it's a reflection of the crisis that journalism is facing here, where no media organization in this country, certainly no print organization, is making money. It means they're cutting back on everything. They're cutting back on expenses. They're cutting back on journalists. They're making journalists do more and more work. And, you know, yes, you know, you see this on the bottom line, and you think, well, you still see the newspapers produced every day. You still see all this content. You know, it looks like South African media is in healthy shape, but we're not. We're really struggling, and it means that good journalism is paying the price.
Mm. Yeah, it is, and then you also have the outside influences of let's say, you know, a big public figure like Cyril Ramaphosa, for example, you know, hugging the limelight. He's a much more newsworthy subject than, let's say, one of the widows
and
from Marikana.
And there's also part of it is this myth that we have that impartial journalism requires giving space to both sides or all sides of a particular issue, and that's you know. So, you know, if you write a story about the police, you have to go and get the police comment. And, you know, and that's not always, I think often that obscures the truth. You sort of weigh up, you present this is one option of how it happened, and this is another option of how it happened, when actually the journalist's goal is to give how it happened, regardless of who they speak to get to that.
Mm-hmm. Mine has shot down the documentary. Have you watched it, Simon?
I have. I watched it at the Bioscope a few months ago, and I just remember being profoundly shocked. You know, to see, I mean, I've seen all the images before, of course, we all have, but to have it put in the narrative, to have it traced all the way through, and just to, you know, and yes, I think there are some problems with the film. I think it doesn't really, it's very light on Amku's role. In precipitating some of the violence which preceded the main shootings. It's very light on Joseph Mutunjwa.
He comes out smelling like roses.
He does. He looks like an absolute legend, yeah, and he's not. He's a nasty piece of work. Mm. But I think that, you know, the stuff he's done pales in comparison to what the police did, because the police have a far greater responsibility, and what it shows is just they just didn't care.
Well, they didn't care for the lives of those people, and you know, and it was clear that those instructions were coming down that this was going to be the day. This was D-Day. Shit was going to go down today if it wasn't going to get resolved. But it was shocking. I mean, it's hard not to be moved by the plight of those thousands of miners who were, you know, engaged in the strike, which is legal, and. Yeah, it's just, and the documentary makes that point, that full circle, that reference to Sharpeville and Soweto in the past, that, you know, it's not any different to those times.
Mm. Yeah.
Sorry, Paul.
I mean, for us, you know, what you brought up earlier, the fact that, you know, the media attention on Marikana, we're not really hearing the voices of miners and widows. I think for us, you know, particularly, you know, thinking what could we do as, you know, a social justice organization to actually ensure that, you know, the voices of miners and their stories are actually told. You know, so we looked around and when we saw Miners Shot Down, we felt that it did a far better job than any of the media out there in exploring the stories of the miners. You know, ETV claims to have done a bunch of documentaries and, you know, exploration of, you know, what happened at Marikana, but, you know, Miners Shot Down, hands down. And then we actually spent time with some of the widows. So there's an incredible woman, widow, Mantabang Nseyahu. So her husband, Andries, you know, was one of the, you know, 34 miners who were shot on 16th of August 2012. And, you know, when we talked to her and she said, you know, it's so important. So many communities across Africa still don't really know what happened in Marikana. And she's felt, you know, her and the other widows felt that if more South Africans could see miners shot down, you know, it's been shown on DSTV, it's been shown on Al Jazeera, but I mean, how many South Africans, the majority of the country, can actually access, you know, those channels? So, you know, that's why they got, the widows got behind this campaign. And she said, you know, we want the story of our husbands to be told. And I think that's why it's such a powerful documentary.
And then this is why it's so important that it's shown on something like free-to-air TV, like SABC or ETV, for example, to get that message out there to the people who don't have access to the internet and don't have access to, you know, to pay television. So how is the campaign going? I mean, you mentioned the 3,000 people. Have you delivered those to the various TV stations?
So, I mean, about a fortnight ago, Greg Nicholson for the Daily Maverick wrote a story about, you know, Miners Shot Down and our campaign, you know, still calling it the documentary all South Africans need to see. And, you know, from there, we'd worked with the widows and we decided, you know, we'll broadcast our campaign. We'll, you know, we'll put a code out there so people can still join the campaign right now if they dial *120*4729# or go to amandla.mobi and, you know, you can still add your voice. So what happened was, thanks to using, you know, USSD codes and also Mixit and also having the campaign online, we had over 3,000 people join the campaign. And so last week, Friday, on the eve of the, you know, the anniversary of the Marikana massacre, we traveled to the SABC studios in Auckland Park and actually, you know, with the widows, Mantabang actually handed over this huge, you know, stack of, you know, signatures of people who had joined the campaign to the SABC. Now, their response was really disappointing. Their spokesperson said that they, you know, had never received formal documentation applying to actually show the documentary on SABC, which completely contradicts what they said 2 weeks ago when Greg Nicholson interviewed them and said, you know, SABC turned around and said, look, we think it's a great documentary.
There were scheduling conflicts or something, I think, is what they said in the first response.
They'd also said, yeah, they'd handed over to SABC too, and the final decision rested with them, and that maybe in 2015 they would find time to schedule it. But now they were claiming they had no knowledge whatsoever. So that made no sense to us and the widows who, you know, had traveled all this way from the Farallon Commission after a really traumatic week. But we did get a commitment from the SABC to, you know, find out what had gone wrong communication-wise within the SABC for them to, you know, lose all this formal documentation. And what the producers from Miners Shot Down said that they would send through all the documentation, the email trail about them submitting the forms. So that was, you know, the experiences at SABC. And from there, we traveled to ETV's offices in, you know, Hyde Park. And it was a very interesting experience. Kind of the gates were kind of put up and we weren't quite allowed through to talk to the spokesperson, but someone did come out and actually formally accept, you know, over 3,000 signatures. But, you know, the ETV's response was they felt they had thoroughly, you know, covered Marikana massacre. Saying this to, you know, 20 of the widows and, you know, with a stack of 3,000 signatures in his hands, he did actually change his mind. And ETV is now committed within a month to getting back to us as to whether they will show, you know, the documentary or not. And I think for us, our hope is that, you know, they do the right thing. I mean, what in the history of South African television, what documentary has got over 3,000 signatures? And I should also add that there was an additional 2,500 people who joined that campaign but didn't give their name. So we only gave them the 3,000 people who put their name down. I mean, a lot of people probably didn't put down their name because this is, you know, it's a really highly political issue. You know, it's a huge gross injustice. But yeah, ETV are going to get back to us. But we really hope that, you know, as I said, they do the right thing. And their decision has nothing to do with Marcel Golding, the CEO of ETV's previous relationship with NUM as their deputy secretary general. So that's the other element at play here.
The documentary takes almost firm aim at Cyril Ramaphosa, I felt. It does. It sort of tries to put him in the spotlight as sort of the main culprit or potentially the main culprit behind this. And also his transformation from, you know, from union leader to capitalist pig, basically, on the other side.
He does come across as very slimy, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
I don't want to trust him.
And
probably the right.
Yeah. And that's also, you know, it sort of my perception or the general public perception, maybe it's just white people's perception of Cyril as a potential leader for this country, is sort of, you know, the disparity between those two images. You know, he's going to be good for business if he takes over. And I guess maybe this does, you know, this is kind of like towing the business line, you know, in the role that he had to play in this whole thing. But he's not the saint. I think that's what I'm trying to get at. He's not the saint that I think people are trying to make him out to be. And this documentary tries to put a lot at his door in terms of, you know, laying the blame or finding someone to blame for the massacre.
Well, Paul, you and I were talking off air, and you were saying that the widows that you were talking to, that their main culprit wasn't the government or Cyril, but it was Lonneman. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I suppose these are the narratives we can create in having these public discussions of who is accountable. But when we actually don't listen to the miners and, you know, the widows themselves. And yeah, the widows do feel that, you know, Lonneman is in some ways getting away scot-free. And I feel like, you know, when you watch Miners Shot Down, they do definitely explore the role Lonneman plays. You know, the fact that, you know, the miners try
the absence of the role that they played, I think, is...
Yeah, that's definitely a more accurate way to describe it, yes. So I think, you know, this is a serious concern going forward. Is, you know, how do we, you know, we've got the Falun Commission going on, but how do we as South Africans, how do we engage with this issue? And that's why, you know, Adamandla.mobi will be looking at launching campaigns in the coming weeks and months ahead to actually stand in solidarity with, you know, the family members and the widows of the Marikana massacre, and actually demand that, you know, justice needs to be served. You know, these, and a lot of these widows are really struggling enormously with, you know, the loss of a breadwinner, and you know, they just blew us away with their courage. You know, coming all the way, you know, to Joburg, you know, from the Falun Commission, you know, after a really horrific week, to actually stand and deliver over 3,000 signatures to ETV and SABC. So it's, you know, I think we really need to get behind, you know, the families who have left behind from this massacre.
Yeah, the other thing that was also quite noticeable in the documentary was the absence of a lot of people who were willing to participate and be interviewed for the documentary. People like Jacob Zuma, Natim Tetwa, Ria Piecha, and a whole host of people, you know, from the government side. And I think it also just speaks volumes to the sort of standoffish, almost hoping for it to go away approach that, you know, dragging this commission out for, what's it, 2 years now, almost 2 years.
Well, it works, doesn't it? I mean, if you look, you know, Cyril comes out as the bad guy because Cyril was talking. The documentary could take aim at Cyril because they had him. They couldn't take, you know, full aim at Natim Tetwa or Jacob Zuma in the same way. And I imagine Cyril is greatly regretting participating in that interview. And I wonder on what terms the filmmakers managed to secure the interview. What did they tell Cyril's office that they were doing?
Also, I suppose Cyril as a government representative, you know, I think, you know, there was pressure on him to, you know, respond. Whereas if you can contrast that with Lonneman, you know, there's far less public pressure on them to have to respond necessarily. So I think, you know, that's another challenge, is that we're not really hearing Lonneman other than their PR spin.
Yeah, and also Cyril's role as, you know, as a union representative from the past, you know, and that whole sort of, you know, coming from the people and now being on the other side of the fence. And I think that's also kind of what boils one's blood a bit when you look at it. And almost you give the sense of desertion, you know, for the sake of the, you know, for sake of money and for sake of the capitalist dream.
Yeah.
And that comes out quite strongly in the documentary as well.
I think we can only hope that, you know, Marcel Golding from ETV doesn't commit a similar, you know, error, you know, coming from NUM, you know, understanding the issues facing mine workers. We can only hope that it won't make the same mistake as perhaps, you know, the accusations of Cyril and the mistakes he's made, and actually ensuring that, you know, justice is served.
It's been 2 years now since the massacre happened. I mean, we get a bit of backlash. Well, you know, from people saying that there's Marikana fatigue, which is crazy to think when something of this, you know, magnitude happens, that, you know, we've got people who you don't really understand the intricacies of what went down that day to be able to say something as ignorant as, you know, like, can we just move on? You know, can we talk about something else? You know, and that's something that, you know, we get, and, you know, and to the credit of our editor, he keeps pushing it, because this is the biggest tragedy of post-South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa. So the things that you guys are doing, I mean, obviously, Despite some of the shortcomings that the documentary has, it is important. That's why we do call it, you know, the documentary that every South African should see. Mm. And there are ways. I believe there you can arrange for private screenings. So it's something that, you know, I've discussed, with our guys that we want to put on a special Daily Maverick screening and see if we can get, you know, some of our audience out there to come and join us and you know, have a screening. So that's something we'll be working on. But, you know, if you're listening out there and, you know, they encourage private screenings at home, and you can arrange that with the producers, you know, get in touch, go to the Minor Shutdown website, get in touch with them. They'll arrange for a copy to be sent to you or that you can go and pick up and screen it out there, because I think it really is something that, A, we must never forget, and B, we've got to get to the, you know, to the truth behind this and real understanding. And so we don't have ignorant people like Steve Hoffmeyer coming out and saying police are getting blamed just for doing their jobs. You know, I mean, that's
unbelievable.
But that is the kind of ignorance that exists out there, and which is a combination of media coverage, possibly a particular viewpoint or standpoint that comes from someone like Steve.
Well, Steve Hoffmeyer does seem to mourn the days when it was the police's job to shoot black people.
Maybe that's what resonates with him. Yeah. That's why he's coming out gung ho in favor of the police on this one. Just talking about that, maybe Andrea, you can come in from this perspective here. So a topic like this, something, an event like this, I mean, the general feeling amongst you and your friends and your kind of friends, what is the appetite to get a fuller understanding of what happened, or is it just kind of let's park this and move on? I mean, you know, you come from a younger demographic than ourselves, so maybe just some perspective from your side.
I would say it's sort of divided. Quite a lot of my friends are very interested and do want to know what really happened and continue to read pieces on marijuana. But it is true that a lot don't, and a lot of conversation, you know, is around much more trivial things. I guess that's always how it is. And I think part of it, again, is just an empathy thing. It's, you know, maybe as you were saying, we don't really hear the voices of the people who are directly affected, and maybe that makes it harder for a lot of us to put ourselves in that position and kind of respond with the sort of outrage that we should be responding with. It's just, I think for a lot of people, it's almost abstract, and obviously it really shouldn't be like that, and it's, yeah, a very, very important thing.
Paul, do you hold any hope for some kind of like legitimate outcome to come out of the commission, for some kind of consequence?
Look, I really do. I think, you know, what happens at Farlam is just such a litmus test for South Africa going forward. Like, do we truly believe in all the sacrifices made before? Do we stand for a just, people-powered democracy? But to be honest with you, if, you know, the outcomes of Farlam aren't as, you know, what we desire, I think, you know, that will be a rallying point for mobilizing more people to actually stand up and actually demand justice. So I think regardless of what's happening, I think it's very interesting. If you read, you know, Daily Maverick today, there's some great pieces by Mark Haywood and Raymond Sattner talking about the future of civil society and democracy in South Africa. And I think it's very clear that it is about, you know, people-powered campaigns. It's about everyday South Africans, you know, standing up. So you don't have to be a lawyer to be able to engage with injustice in our country, that, you know, everyday citizens can begin to take action. So I think that's my hope. And I also think with our campaign targeting ETV and SABC, it is crystal clear that neither of those broadcasters can use the excuses and tactics they've been using in the past. They know that over 3,000 people are watching them and waiting for an outcome, and that, you know, we'll continue to mobilize people. I mean, every day we have people pouring in, more people joining the campaign on Amandla.mobi. So I think we're very, very hopeful. And even if, you know, they still refuse, we'll continue to campaign and demand justice. So I think this is just the beginning of a big battle.
What in your perspective, in your opinion, were the differences between the documentaries that ETV themselves produced and Minor Shutdown?
I mean, I think it's really, you know, those documentaries I don't feel gave enough space to actually talk to the miners and actually analyze the context in which, you know, what was the backstory on what led to the events of, you know, August 16th. I feel, you know, there wasn't enough time given to, you know, miners to listen to their stories. But I mean, it's also, I mean, Miner Shutdown, you know, there's a lot to explore. But we definitely didn't hear the voices of widows as much as we should. But I mean, there's a lot of the team at Uhuru Productions have loaded a lot of videos exploring what's, you know, widow stories and letting them talk about these issues. But I mean, I think the other documentaries, yeah, I don't feel they've had as much of a response. Like when people watch them, they haven't necessarily been outraged or inspired to take action as much. And I think that's a problem. And I think that's why, you know, when we look at this issue of marijuana, I think why we have this almost fatigue is this sense of people feeling overwhelmed. You know, they get that it was an injustice, but they don't know what to do. And I think this is the challenge for South African civil society going forward and activists is like, how do we provide ways that people can take action that has a real impact? So yeah, I think that's the reason why I think we feel Minor Shutdown does a much better job of exploring the issue than the other documentaries.
Okay, so if people want to get involved with the petition, amandla.mobi or run the USSD, just maybe give us that USSD code again.
Yeah, no problem. So, I mean, yeah, as I said earlier, like we're working to, amandla.mobi is working to turn every cell phone into a democracy building tool. So anyone can get out their cell phone and just dial this code that works on all phones. It's *120*4729#. And then people can select English, Setswana, and isiZulu. And we're, you know, we're a small organization, there's only three of us. And, you know, we don't accept any government funding, corporate funding, or political party funding. We're actually, you know, at the moment, you know, just got a little bit of funding, and we're actually getting donations from everyday South Africans. So we're really people-funded and people-powered social justice movement. So people can dial that code. They can find us on Mixit at amandla.mx or online, of course, amandla.mobi. And we're running a multitude of campaigns and launching new ones each week.
Okay, and what other campaigns are live at the moment? What other things are, you know, have got the petitions going?
Yeah, so there's obviously, you know, this issue of the police confiscating blankets from the homeless, which Greg Nicholson from Daily Maverick also covered. So that's a, you know, campaign we're working on at the moment. There's this issue of blackface at University of Pretoria. There's Marikana. But also we're looking at staying in solidarity with workers from Sun City who were protesting unfair dismissal and privacy violations, and they were shot with live ammunition by security guards at Sun City. So our question is it Sun City or is it Sun City? And so we're actually demanding that Sun City do an independent investigation into what happened and why live ammunition was used on workers who were just using their democratic right to strike.
And with Marikana being like literally not, you know, just kilometers away from there, you'd think that they'd be a little bit sensitive to the issues of using live ammunition on protesters.
Yeah, although the Sun City spokesman turned around and said they had avoided a mini Marikana, which I think is ignorance and arrogance on a scale untold. So that's another campaign we're running.
We've got a tweet here on the Cliff Central account that's come in and asking the question, haven't seen the documentary, but don't you think the police were in fear for their own lives? And I think, you know, if you watch the documentary, it kind of lays out quite clearly, you know, whose lives were in danger and what led to the deaths of those police officers. So, you know, to why dupes, go out and watch the documentary and then ask the question again, I think is the answer to that
Absolutely.
One.
Absolutely. The answer will be very, very clear.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the most telling thing was on the morning of the 16th, when as part of the preparations, when part of the, you know, I mean, there were almost thousands of cops that were there, and four mortuary vans were dispatched ahead of the day's proceedings. And I mean, if that isn't an indictment of, you know, of the police's expected behavior and what was going to unfold that day, then I don't think anything else could be. Okay, we've reached the end of our session. That's the end of the Daily Maverick Show for this week. We'll be back every Tuesday at 1 p.m., or you can catch us on the podcast available from the cliffcentral.com website or from Daily Maverick. We look forward to hosting you again next week. Goodbye.